phenomena that occur in debate rounds, which may or may not be desirable depending upon your point of view, but it sure the hell makes the 1AR and 2AR very interesting. And I know a lot of you confront these difficulties for the first time while you're in competition. The purpose of the exercise today is so when this happens to you, you'll have a sense of what you might want to do, rather than figuring it out on the spot. When the list is completed, when we get through the entire list, I'm going to ask the panel to start talking about ways that they think 1ARs and 2ARs can improve their skills and give you some ideas how to do it. Traditionally, I think, almost without exception, people will argue that the 1AR is one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult speeches in academic debate. And it's an incredible challenge, and people like to screw you up. People spend all their time trying to figure out, how can I screw up the 1AR? And we're going to talk about the list today and our ways to survive. Do you have one? Do you like one?
Yeah.
Do we have a copy? If you have extra, can we get them sent back down, please? That way we have a general location. You're here for us. Are you here for us? Now I'm going to ask the panel to like start at the top and read it through and just chat about it for a while and then just move on.
So what if the negative block includes the derivative topicality argument off responses to another topicality argument from the 1MC? So picture that this just happened. What do we do?
One of us is answer it. It's I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's probably their first real chance to make this argument. Sometimes you say unexpected stuff in the 2AC that sets up stuff that they can say in the negative block. So, you know, mostly I think just make sure you've got a couple of substantive answers to the actual topicality argument. If you thought out why you're topical on all the words before the round started, then you should probably have something to say. And that's how you prevent walking into arguments where your answers to one heap prove the other one's true. So you can say that and just use it. Have to do that if I go last every time. Yeah. That's why we're going to go this way.
You guys are really hard to hear.
Yeah.
Really hard to hear?
Yeah,
speak up.
Well, half of you are sitting in the back of the theater, like there's all these empty chairs, you know.
Number two, right, blame the audience.
Okay. So, imagine a case where the negative block includes a critique which started as a disadvantage in the 1NC. So if this ad mutates into a critique somewhere in the negative block, so what do we do about this?
Well, I would say to begin with, that's something you should deal with after the 1MC. Sometimes people, I've seen teams now who are starting to not run implications to their arguments that seem very critique-y. And I think those are the sort of things that, well, obviously in this situation, this happens later in the debate. But in most situations, I would say after the 1MC, when there's a semi-critique-y argument that has no clear implications, that those things need to be fleshed out and cross-checked immediately. You want to find out whether they think this is a case term, whether they think it's a critique, or what they want to call it, and what sort of implications it's going to have for the debate long before this ever happens. And I think that if they do in fact mutate it, then that justifies a lot of new answers from the 1AR. And you might even want to go so far as to claim that justifies new answers in other arguments as well, if you just want to use the negative team trying to mess with you.
I think to establish that it mutated, well, I think that you might want to think about establishing that it mutated. If I'm the judge and I see this position as strategically ambiguous, it may just look like you fell in the trap, pretty much. And so the 1AR has to make the argument, we get some new answers at the critique level of it. And to do that, you need to say, here's the thing about this, like, here's the thing about this argument that's misleading. Here's the label that says to me if it did that. That's why we answered it to this app. Now that it's newly been re-explained as critique, then we get answers to that function or component of it as well.
Good question.
Okay. Does the agency come out and say, okay, changing our discussion of 15, you're like, how do you keep, like, consistently know or, like,
the way
that it's changed from this
The way that they argue the impact, originally it'll be as though it's a systematic impact that X causes X to happen and then X occurs. And then when they change back to, well, maybe, you know, because the most of the time the morphism occurs when people find out that they're just X but not very unique and that other thing could cause it. So then they move back and critique to, you should reject this every time, or you should always move away from doing this instead of depending upon A causing B causing C.
They may not be so explicit as to say it wasn't just that, it was now a critique. That makes your job a little easier if they do that. They'll probably just say it wasn't just that, it was a critique. and in order to justify why you get some new answers, you probably have to say, here's why, here's how we know it changed. Here's how we know it wasn't that in the 1MC.
I think that you should also still utilize your answers that the 2AC originally put out and figure out how they apply to this impact if it's turned into a critique. And then you just have to focus on, most of the time, the impact of the critique, why it's a voter, why you should lose, compared to maybe your advantages. So maybe you do some comparison about how the policy is more important than maybe the critique or the outside round effect. So you can still argue that you don't look at the non-unique aspects of the critique. You still maintain a view of the policy and try to figure out how to keep away from the impact of the critique.
I tend to think if you want to have the outcome of the round be under control, and you want to make the arguments that matter in the round arguments that are about substance and less arguments that are about how judges should look at rounds, I think that people have kind of a way that they deal with new arguments. I'm not saying it's inflexible. I'm not saying they're not open to listening to it. But I think you're much better off if you can beat the substance of an argument than hoping that the judge agrees with you on some theory question. And so I definitely agree with Jack. If you could find ways to morph those 2AC answers into something that matters, by all means, that's a priority.
They don't always go away, and it's still the same argument. It's just the way the argument's evaluated in the round kind of changes. So you got to keep your 2AC argument in the debate. You can't just freak out and assume, oh, no, it's a critique. Where's my 24 critique frontline answers? And then read those. That's what they want you to do, in a sense, and you got to keep away from that. You got to maintain your strategy also.
Oh, and make sure that it's not, this question says includes critique that started as a dissat. Maybe it became a critique, but it might still also be a dissat.
Yes.
That'd be a good thing to sort of sort out before you overcommit to the other interpretation of the 1AR.
Number 3.
The negative adds new impacts to the disadvantages in the 2NC. So maybe they have another scenario for the disadd, and that comes out in the blog.
I think that if you are well-researched, well-organized, I think the best strategy, it matters on how big the 2NC blooms the impact, but I think always a good strategy is for the 1AR to go there and spend 2 minutes reading cards, turning the impact, because the 2NR can't sit there and read cards in the 2NR. And so I think that that's a prime opportunity for the 1ARs to win the debates by running impact turns on the new impact that the 2NC runs. I think it's very strategic. Sometimes you may hear the 1AR read 4 minutes of impact turns there, if that's what the most important part of the debate can be. And so then, if that's what you do in the 1AR, then you also have to do some arguments saying that this is the most important aspect of the debate, or this is the biggest impact of the debate. That way you know that you focused in the right place and you made arguments to make where you've read these cards in the right place on the flip.
The best defense is a good offense in the 1AR. That if the negative block does something new that lets you straight turn it, consider that possibility. That really puts the 2NR in a bind. They're probably going to have to spend all their time on the position that's straight turned to win it back. where they're going to have to go for something like hospitality that operates at a completely different level. And so you really tie the two in our hands as far as what they can go for. Now I guess if you want them to go, if you think you're losing the disad and you want the disad to go away, maybe giving them outs is a good idea. But certainly a new position in the negative block gives you the opportunity to straight turn something and make the two in our decision for them. And that sounds like a very powerful thing to do. I might also add that I think that a lot of times your best answers to disads are occurring at the link level anyway. And so, if you're emphasizing link turns or whatever, and just kind of say whatever, you'll beat the link in a lot of these cases too.
I wouldn't really have a whole lot to add to that, except that I think you might also be able to make the claim that would justify other new answers in other places if there are strategic gaps that you have. If they're reading a lot of new impact stories, maybe you could at least talk about how that would justify some new arguments in other places that might be useful.
Okay. Number four. What if the 2NC spends her whole speech pimping the case? What this means, if any of you aren't familiar with this specific terminology, is if the 2NC gets up and makes a lot of arguments that are not evidence about how your evidence doesn't say this, it says probably, you know, this doesn't mention Cuba specifically, making analytical arguments that just sort of press the strength of the evidence. So if the 2NC spends 8 minutes doing that, it can look kind of intimidating if you have arguments all over the case.
Say you might have like 60 of each.
I think when this happens, you kind of group it, say it's fascinating, and then move on. I'll say that with an asterisk. In some cases, there are useful analytical arguments that make a lot of sense and call into question the internal links of the impacts or those sorts of things, where the arguments you do need to answer. But if they're just saying this card doesn't say that, or maybe this card isn't conclusionary enough or whatnot, then ultimately you can probably group all their arguments together and point out that even if they win 100% of those things, all they do is maybe throw some doubt on the case, which is not a reason to vote against you. Right? There's still substantive reasons in the evidence that you would want to vote for the affirmative, and if all they've done is call some things into question, then that's probably not enough reason to vote against you. I wouldn't waste any time on it.
I would certainly not get into this game of a line-by-line, because you can't do it. I mean, you can't answer line-by-line 60 different arguments in the 1AR. If this really is a significant element of the negative strategy, and if you think you've got a judge who might groove on this a little bit, I might, at the top of each of the structures of the case, observation 1, observation 2, bench 1, bench 2, have like a 4 or 5 sentence, like kind of overview that answers the essence of most of the arguments, but I would never get to the point where you're going line by line with these kinds of things, because you will drop something that matters somewhere else.
I think you should, at the top of the case, give a brief, like maybe 2 or 3 arguments on why evidence is better than no evidence, and then go through, and you have to be aware, like some of their pimps may be links to their off-case positions that are hidden within their pimps. Some of their pimps may be comparative arguments that give their off-case positions ground over your case, like they may say, this will mean that our time frame on our disad will come before the affirmative case. And you have to be aware of those type of arguments that could hurt you when the 2NR comes around. And at least go to those and answer those. But if they're like, Kark says should, doesn't say always, you can go group my next 3 cards. They have 9 arguments. Read the evidence. I think it says what I needed to say. That way you put the burden on your evidence. And if your evidence is read, then it should say what it says. You shouldn't have it in your 1AC anyway. So I think with those that are dealing with the quality or how your evidence works, I think that you should, if your evidence says it, then I think you should just say, read the cards on these. But I need to answer this link they're trying to get off my C sub point down here. Also, I need to answer the card, my time frame, or my Riley to Brink card. They do a time frame analysis. You probably need to answer that.
Okay.
And that's just being aware. That means that what I do is I would put a square or a circle around those arguments, 1 or 2 inches, making them. If I thought, wow, you know, if they win this argument, it could make a difference in the debate at the end as far as does their impacts come before our case impacts, or do their impacts outweigh our impacts? Like if you have a moral obligation, sometimes the 2NC will do some comparisons of maybe your moral obligation and maybe the one in R is going for an off case. Now, if there's no off case dissatisfaction, right, if the 1NR is going to do T and the 2NC does case pimps, well, then, you know, you're going to have to worry about covering the T debate, but then you're like, there is no offense, they have no evidence, and then maybe do a big overview on why you should win, because you're the only one that can possibly get an advantage when there's no disadvantages in the case.
Yeah, this is a significant vulnerability on the part of the negative block that needs to be exploited. You get so much more time to deal with the real arguments if this is going to be the negative strategy.
Okay. 2NC blows up the critiques, disadvantages, and counterplan, while 1NR blows up a set of solvency arguments for 6 minutes. Just to start off, in this case, I think that it might be important for you to go to solvency first in the 1NR. This might be a point of contention or a point of debate. Oftentimes, your arguments on the disadvantages and counterplan, your leverage against those is going to come from your solvency. Your advantage is usually stemmed from that. So,
well, it seems to me that, and this is a situation with the negative block's done probably a reasonably good job to spread the 1AR out. I think that there are a few things you can do to deal with these sorts of situations. The first happens before you ever get to the debate tournament, where you sit around with your partner on the affirmative and you all talk about your strategic answers to all the positions you think you're going to hear. Right? Long before you ever get to the tournament, you all just sat around and said, all right, if we hear Clinton, these are our three best arguments, and these are the arguments we have to go for on the Clinton debate. And you should do that for all of the arguments, so that when you get into a spread round where you don't have lots of time to go for everything, you already have a good idea between the two of you of how you're going to pick and choose in the debate. It will clearly be impossible for you to go for all of your 2AC partners' 2AC answers, so two of you need to be on the same page about how to go about doing that. And then when you actually get into the round, that's what you need to do. Pick the most strategic or offensive arguments you have and then go for those alone and be willing to sacrifice other arguments that you can't win a debate on. The best answers to dissats aren't necessarily the ones that you think make the most sense. They're the ones that your 2AR can best explain why they take out the dissat. And a lot of times I think 1ARs make the mistake of not considering the 2ARs preference especially. Another way to think about it is that a position that the other team initiates, like a critique or a dissat or a counterplan, if it's the right argument, the 2AR can beat that on one argument, possibly. On the other hand, solvency, where they've got a whole bunch of solvency attacks against your original position, you're going to need to win a decent chunk of that stuff in order to win that you have solvency. So you're probably going to need to allocate a little bit more of your time there. If the 1AR is running out of time, if you've got, you know, 45 seconds left, you've got two dissats to cover, it's easy to go and pick and go, here's the two answers I need on each. If you get to an incredibly developed solvency dump with 45 seconds, I think you don't have a prayer. So you want to make sure that you leave things and kind of put things at the end that you can do very quickly and efficiently should your back be against the wall at that point in the 1AR.
I think the first thing you do is you be straight up honest with yourself and decide if the solvency arguments really apply or not. If they're true, if they can actually win them, and if they're right. Because at that point in the debate, you can put focus maybe on dissad turns that maybe the 2AC put out, or critique turns that the 2AC put out. And so you have to kind of look for some form of truth in their solvency arguments compared to your case. Because if their solvency arguments are right, then you might be able to spend 6 minutes on them in the 1AR and still not win solvency. And so at that point, then you have to step over and put off and go for the offense or the turns that you have on the other positions. However, I think that the 2NR won't be able to go for the critique, the dissat, and the counterplan. If they do, it will not be a very strong extension of all three of those. And in order to win that strategy most of the time, I think they feel as though they can win a solvency deficit. I think you would want to win case first, and then have a strategy on how you're going, you know, if you're going to attack the disadvantage on linked terms, then that's how you do it, because in this case you wouldn't have a lot of time to waste, and then if you're going to attack the critiques on the linked terms and on the impact level, then that's what you do in the 1AR. But I think you definitely win case first, because that gives 2AR the ability to say, hey, I win case, I win the debate. And one small good argument against the dissad, the critique, and the counterplan, and each of them could actually be beat. So always win your case first in that instance, unless you think that you're going to lose case. If you know you're like, man, these are these solvency arguments that I knew our case can't solve for, you know, and you've been worried about it all year, you carry the same file, you're hoping nobody else had it, and they read it, then you got to go for your turns on your other position.
I want to endorse something that Jackie just said about knowing, being honest with yourself and knowing what you're losing. One of the most dangerous affirmative teams is the affirmative team that's losing almost everything and has only one shot to win the round, and they know what it is. Because come the 1AR, that's about all that they talk about. They just kind of like go to the other positions and put them into context, and boom, they're going for the one thing. And I've seen all kinds of teams where they, you know, the 2ACs drop an argument left and right. The 1AR is brilliant, stands up with a zip crap and goes for this argument and knows why those two arguments are enough to win them the round. And so, and a lot of that comes from being honest with yourself and knowing that you're not winning every argument in the round.
One additional comment I would make is I think that what Eric said makes a lot of sense, and especially in the context of the fact that most strategic affirmatives probably don't have to win all of their advantages to win the debate. I would say in most situations you would want to have at least one advantage that you don't necessarily plan to go for that you want to have in the debate just so you can suck some 2NC evidence or just get some evidence out of the negative. In those situations that you want to set it up so that the 1AR has sort of a pre-planned disco about which arguments they need to go for in the case. So maybe half the solvency arguments apply to the first advantage. If you're not going to go for that, you can automatically sort of get rid of those arguments in the first place. You don't have to deal with them. And so you all want to plan those sort of things out ahead of time.
Okay, number 6. 2AC drops a major argument, such as a disadd or counterplan, and the negative block takes advantage of it. Or 2AC drops a topicality argument.
New answers.
Yeah, you might as well say something about it. I mean, this is obviously far from an ideal situation. If it's not the topicality argument, if it's a disadd or something like that, you might really look around at your answers on the other disadds. One good thing about affirmatives that use generic non-uniqueness arguments like, hey, we just lifted sanctions on, on Iran for humanitarian assistance, is that these things remarkably seem to apply to all the off-case positions about equally, And to say something like that to get across half is fairly obvious, it's fairly straightforward, so you can probably convince the judge to let you do that. Hopefully it's not, utterly blatant. I've seen people get out of drawing topicality arguments, arguing that it's a search for truth, and we've got to look at the truth of the topicality argument, and we really honestly completely don't violate it. I guess if you're one of the people who likes to do a lot of counter-standardy kinds of stuff when you answer T, well, that stuff's going to apply to all the T violations. You're going to have to make new arguments, you're going to have to say why you get to do that. And really, you want the round to be about not whether the judge likes new arguments, you want the round to be about whether or not your 3 or 4 reasons why your arguments were okay were better than their reasons why your arguments are bad. You want to make that an issue that's debated in the round, not an issue that's pre-imposed by the judge's philosophy, as much as you can.
I think then, of course, like Eric says, you become the god of cross-application from other positions. I also think that you take advantage of the positions that you're winning also, so you may have dropped a disadd or a counterplan. Maybe there's other arguments you're winning, and you can figure out how to take those arguments and use them to beat back or to answer back the disadd or the counterplan. And then the other thing is, and I've seen this happen before, is for the affirmative to spend more focus in ballooning their impacts. In other words, saying, oh, I have this disadd I'm going to have to outweigh now. How am I going to get this out of my affirmative case? and trying to, you know, sometimes that means extrapolate, but definitely try to get your impact as large as you can from your case and make that very noticeable. And even in the 1AR, you can set up, you know, I've seen debaters like at the bottom set up a standard or how to make the best impact analysis. That way the 2AR has a way that, you know, something that was set up for them in order to prove why their case will be this disadvantage that was dropped. But I guess it sometimes just gives a tool for the critic to go, oh yeah, it was there, and they told me how I was going to have to deal with it. I guess, and that just kind of, you got to figure out a way to get you back into the debate where you're not totally discounted from the debate. So, and sometimes that just involves that focusing on the argument that you are winning, for sure.
One other way to deal with topicality is, especially if there's a critique in the debate that you might be winning, to talk about why the implications, especially if they go for critique of some sort of theoretical implications or in that sense, if you're winning the critique or you're link-turning it for some reason, I would spend some time talking about how the implications of the critique outweigh topicality and how you evaluate those sorts of things. And the other suggestion I would have is in this sort of situation, you want to start looking for blatantly new arguments that came out in the 2NC that allow you to justify new arguments in the 1AR that might be helpful to you in the debate.
Yeah, my answers to those new 2NC arguments might, interestingly enough, be really applicable to the argument that I dropped as well, if I can find a way to do that.
Definitely.
I think this also falls into the category of the going for critique turns or why your case outweighs of figuring out that you're losing and that you maybe only have one way to win and committing heavily to that way if that's really your situation.
Okay. Let's look at number 8. What if the 2NC runs new arguments? So if they shell out maybe a whole new disad or a critique, counterplant, something of that nature. Your arguments are obviously going to depend on the type of argument that is new in the 2NC.
Turn it. The main reason why 2NC disads are a bad idea is because the 1AR always has the option of standing up and either link turning or impact turning the position, in which case you are...
No kick out. No alternative. Let's go for it now.
Right. A smart 1AR would stand up and read a big stack of link turns and a stack of uniqueness answers, and not give the negative any way to kick out of it. Alright, so in that situation, while it seems like it could be a problem for the 1AR, this is definitely a situation where the 1AR could easily become the most offensive speech in the debate. Keeping in mind that the 2NR is the only speech in which the negative is going to have an opportunity to deal with the strategy the 1AR chooses. So, unless it's something you haven't prepped out for, this should be a beneficial thing for the 1AR, for the affirmative team, at least in my opinion.
Sorting out links versus link turns or impact versus impact turns takes time. That's why negatives ought to like to be doing that in the negative block, and you know it's going to be abbreviated and limited, and I just think straight turning is an excellent strategy choice when this happens. Not every argument can be straight turns. Sometimes your turns really stink, I guess, but you know, if you've got a decent turn strategy, it would be nice to commit to it as opposed to giving them a way out of it.
If you don't have the turn cards, a different alternative. I think that you know how a lot of times you're tempted to want to grab the 2AC front line and read what the 2AC front line says. I think that when you're in the 1AR, what the 2NC would love for you to do is just to read the 2NC pins that they usually read, like no link, no ring, no threshold, because those arguments don't really get you anywhere, and that makes it easy for the 2NR. So what you have to do is definitely make the link answer and maybe make the uniqueness answer, but you have to read some evidence. If you read some evidence on the position, that makes it harder for the 2NR to win that position because they then have to spend time in their 2NR reading evidence. And but I think, like they say, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to impact turn or link turn, whatever they're doing, because that sticks them with the position. If you think you can win the round, don't do it. If you think that maybe you can't win that position if you have a bad color file or whatever the argument might be.
What if, in number 9, the 2NC blows up the 1NC, and after cross X, the 1NR waves her speech because the 1AR is particularly weak? So, 1NR just waves their speech. I wouldn't suggest this as a strategy in the first place. I think that all speech time, even if you are a particularly strong 2NC, all speech time is going to get you somewhere unless you make it an error.
Yeah, I think it shows that maybe you have an attitude problem. I mean, I don't know, but if the round comes down in such a way that the negative after doing this is, manages to lose it somehow, I'll probably be smirking after I'm walking out of there.
I say stand up 1AR. That would be my answer back to it would. I mean, you've had 3 minutes to prep. The 2NC hasn't been able to prep anything that they just spoke about. And so you've had 3 minutes to prep during your 1AR, and really that should have been 3 minutes on 2NC stuff. And so if the 1AR says, I waive my speech, and I think you should stand up in the 1AR, and then you have the 2NC that's not really ready because they're dependent upon your 1AR prep and the 1NR speech to actually get ready to do their 2NR.
Yeah, they're not backfoot or anything. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Also, I really don't see any way in which this really puts the 1AR in a worse position. If the 1NR had chosen to give the speech, then the 1AR would now have more to answer, and they'd have to spend that time flowing to figure out what the 1NR was saying. So I don't see how this really helps the negative, especially.
Yeah, and especially if the negative's used up most of their prep time, like the 2NC used up a lot of prep before the 2NC, then definitely the stand-up 1AR would hurt the 2NR badly.
I think the stand-up 1AR is always a good idea, personally. I think that if you're a 1AR after a while and you've been giving the speech for a good period of time, at some point you ought to attempt to, instead of flowing the negative blocks arguments, you should make an effort to try and flow only your answers. I guess I could go into this in greater detail at some other point, but there is that's a fairly effective way to save massive amounts of prep time. Especially given that you have the 3 minutes of prep time during the 2NC cross-ex, you can generally get most of your arguments and you can get most of your arguments down long before the 1NR ever stands up. And in this situation, I don't know, I'm not sure what the negative strategy really becomes if they're skipping 6 minutes of speech time. Maybe they just want to lose.
The stand-up 1AR also has arguments for it. I mean, you rarely can do the stand-up 2AC. Usually the 2AC's got to write some answers to something or another. And the 2AC's got to be pretty close to right. I mean, some of these problems we listed above, even though there's ways out of them, they're really it's really bad if the 2AC misunderstands an argument or drops a T position or whatever. And so sometimes your 2ACs can be little prep time piggies, and the 1AR has to be able to compensate for that. And if the 2AC knows the 1AR can compensate for that, then they'll be a little bit more thorough and make sure they get it all covered.
Okay, let's skip down to number 12. The 2NR goes for one argument and blows it up, and the 2AR has no prep time remaining. At that point, you've got to go.
During the 2NR prep time, you should be thinking about what the negative is likely going to go for. And I think that a good 2AR probably is going to spend that prep time writing out overviews for the potential options the negative has. If you're fairly honest with yourself about what the arguments are in the debate, you can probably figure out what the negative is going to go for. If you put yourself in the negative shoes, if I were negative, I would go for the counterplan, the case turn, and the did that, and whatnot. And I think you should make those strategic assessments on your own and prepare for it, especially if you know you have zero prep time remaining or you have 1 minute left. You probably want to have some sort of overview at the top written down for yourself, and only so you can have your thoughts organized about that particular strategy. In that case, use their prep time.
The very dangerous thing you can do in a situation like this is to give all of the arguments that you still have on this dissat or whatever equal weight in the 2AR. You shouldn't do that. The arguments aren't equally good. You ought to be emphasizing two or three things the most, and sort of, I think, mainly the tone of this speech is, if you vote on this dissat, you should have a real good explanation about how they answered X, Y, and Z, so that you know the judge spends a lot of time putting a lot of energy on them. The 2AR has got to got to signal what's really important with the time that they spend there and explaining how this specific no link or this specific non-meekness argument really does utterly deny any risk of the dissat. And so you want to spend some time on arguments that you want the judge to give serious consideration to. And that's going to be a lot easier, I guess, if you have no prep time, because those are the arguments that you know about. It's going to be the easiest thing to do is to talk about your two or three best arguments, and I think that's the right reaction.
If you know you have no prep time, when you're listening to the 2NR and you realize, wow, they're just going to the counter plan, then that's when you also take your other flows and set them beside your flow while you're flowing the 2NR and start looking over those other flows and seeing if there's other ways that you can beat this position without ever even having to go to it. I mean, of course you'll go to it, but look for other ways, maybe other arguments you've made in the debate that you think can help you beat this position that the 2NR didn't even go to. That might be a turn on a critique where you claim that we win the debate or we get a lead turn over on the critique that they ignored. That might mean some type of argument you may make on case against the solvency argument that proves that gets you out of the dissat. I mean, you got to focus, look for other areas in the debate that 2NR didn't go to that could help you win that debate. And so you get your other flows, set them right there by you, and start looking down them as you're flowing the 2NR and seeing if there's other places that could help you beat them on that debate. But then you have to focus. You can't, you know, you can't be still trying to extend all of your 2AC answers and your 2AR. You have to break it down to what you think your three best options probably are to beat the position, and then focus on those options.
Yeah, you can't just be flowing the 2NR like Jack is saying. You've got to be thinking about, you know, the 2NR is your prep time as well as their speech time, and so you need to hear the gist of what they say, but also make sure that, you know, you're thinking about your 2AR at that point. But you can't just like freshly stand up and completely change focus from utterly flowing to utterly speaking and make the transition effectively. I also think this is a great role for the 1AR. You know, I might go through this argument looking for stuff, but then I might also have my 1AR doing that too,
yeah,
because they're in a better position to do this kind of thing. I mean, in a lot of ways, if you think about it, the 1NR and the 1AR are free to do useful stuff during the later parts of the rounds. I've seen situations where, like, the 1NR will just, like, you know, ignore their old flows and just write down each and every 1AR argument and circle the ones that are new arguments so that, you know, give that sheet to the 2NR before they stand up. You know, the 1AR can do the same thing to the 2NR, just like, you know, do a straight line flow with their stuff, circle what's new on the position. They could also be going through the other flows looking for things that are vulnerabilities.
I also think that you should have your 1AR, because like if they go for a dissat and the 2NR block, I think you should have your 1AR get their impact cards and figure out and do an impact analysis for you. Figure out maybe how to write out a brief comparison or something, because you can actually, they could go for a whole dissat, and if your case impact outweighs the dissat impact, the 2NR could spend 25 minutes on it and you still win the debate. And so you can have your, you know, that's where the judge will focus on the impact card. So have your 1AR compare the impact cards. And that's one way that you can win the debate in like the last 30 seconds of your 2AR just by reading the comparison that the 1AR has written for you or made for you about the impact evidence of the case and then of the disadvantage.